Hi, friends of war. I always forget which podcast I am in. This is our English podcast. Forgive me. Welcome back. And today we have a juicy topic for you because... Hi, Joel. How are you?
Hello, Francisco.
Today we're talking about something that is a great example of how the management of reality works. And here at More, we are the management of reality. So let's get right into it. They're saying that there is starvation going on in Gaza, right? And this is an added accusation to support the ongoing campaign to convince people that there is genocide in Gaza, that the Israelis are supposedly committing genocide in Gaza. Now, obviously, this kind of campaign is directed to manipulate the moral emotions of Westerners, right? Because, of course, if you're a Judeo-Christian Westerner and there's a group of people causing another group of people to starve, then naturally your emotional, moral reaction is to defend the people who are being oppressed with starvation, right? What else are you going to do as a good moral Judeo-Christian Westerner, right? You're supposed to defend the weak, fight for the oppressed, oppose injustice, and yes, all that good stuff, right? This is what we do. Right. So this is the framing is that the Israelis are oppressing the Arab Palestinians. Right. This is what they want you to believe. So how do they do it? So the New York Times publishes a photograph that I'm going to show you. It's amazing what they did. So let me see. Where is this? I lost it. Oh, here it is, I think. Yeah. So the New York Times publishes a photograph, and here it is, that appears to show a malnourished child being held by his mother. Okay? So you look at this photograph and you say to yourself, oh my God, that child is very, very thin. He is abnormally thin. And the New York Times is a respected publication, and it's telling you that there is starvation in Gaza. Obviously, if they're using this picture, it must be because the child is starving, right? The mother looks perfectly well fed, right? But the child somehow is starving, right? So forget about the contradiction between a well-fed mother and her own child who is not getting enough food. I mean, that would mean that the mother was taking food away from the child, right?
Yeah.
How can you have a well-fed mother and a starving child? How does that make any sense, right? But let's move that to one side. The child looks thin, right? Too thin. So the mind thinks there must be starvation in Gaza. Otherwise, how could the child look like this, right? And it's the New York Times. It's a very high, the most high prestige newspaper in the world, right? So the mind thinks I'm looking at starvation. Except that... almost immediately after that picture was published, an independent journalist by name David Collier, and this is, everybody, this is why we need independent journalism, right? Because we can't trust the big brands. The big brands lying to us, right? So what did this independent journalist do? This guy managed to get the medical records of that little boy. And the medical records indicate that this boy had serious pre-existing health conditions, including cerebral palsy, hypoxemia, and possible genetic disorder, which affected his muscle development. Okay? So he's not a malnourished child. He is a child with deformities due to medical conditions that affect negatively his muscle development. All right? That's what we're looking at. So now you have to ask yourself, So then what happened? So then the New York Times admitted that this was a sick and deformed child. They admitted, they confessed in public that they had used the photo of a malformed child to try to convince us that there was starvation in Gaza. They confessed to this. But in the confession, so you know, they published these retractions. And it's never the front page story, right? The front page story, yes, with the front page photograph, that's the lie, right? That's going to stay there for everybody to remember. And the correction happens in a little box that nobody sees. Mm-hmm. Right? But what they said in that box was, that that the child, yes, has these medical conditions, but he is also malnourished. So they tried to say, well, yeah, true, that's a very sick child, but he's also malnourished. But see, here's the problem. Since they were doing something dishonest from the beginning, right? Why should you believe the New York Times that this child is malnourished? Why should you believe the same liars when they try to correct their lie, right? So, he's sick, but he's also malnourished. Why should you believe that? Especially considering that the mother looks perfectly well-fed. The mother looks well-fed. And the other thing that David Collier, this independent journalist, documented, was that there was no documentation of the twin brother of that child being malnourished. So neither the brother nor the mother are malnourished. This child looks a little bit thin, and that's supposed to convince us, this unfortunately deformed child is supposed to convince us that there's starvation in Gaza. Okay. Now,
yeah.
Where would the New York, the next question is, where would the New York Times source the claim that the child is malnourished anyway? Where would the information that the child is malnourished come from? And the answer is, it would come from the Gaza Ministry of Health, because that child is in Gaza. So there's nobody else to provide medical information about this child that is not the Gaza Ministry of Health. But guess what? The Gaza Ministry of Health is Hamas, because Hamas is the government in Gaza. So the claim that there is starvation in Gaza has been established by the New York Times with a photo of a child that is obviously not starving, a child that is sick and has a muscular condition, a condition that affects the growth of his muscles, right? A child, he's not starving, he has a medical condition, and the claim that the child is supposedly starving comes from the Gaza terrorists, who have an interest in convincing the world that the Israelis are bad people who are hurting the Arab Palestinians.
What I can see here, Francisco, is that one too many times, the New York Times and other brands, what they do is they misinterpret or they lie with big pictures, right? Very impressive pictures to the entire population. And then the image, it's already in your head.
Exactly.
And then they correct yourself, themselves, or whatever, but that's later, right?
Let's
first propagate this lie towards the majority of population that we can't, that we can, and then let's see what happens. You know, like then we can say the reaction if they see that that there is a lie, okay, then we can defend ourselves. But if they don't see that there is a lie, we continue propagating this lie.
Right. Well, this is what happens most of the time. So most of the time, you see the lie on the front page with the big picture, you know, and the New York Times has done this several times, right? So I'll remind our audience of the hospital in Gaza that supposedly the Israelis had bombed. And then it turned out it was discovered only thanks to a video that was taken by the people in Gaza, right? Thanks to that video, it was people were able to show that, in fact, it was a missile from the terrorists that had failed to launch and that had fallen on the parking lot of the hospital. The hospital had not been destroyed. It was just the parking lot that had been destroyed. The missile came from the terrorists, not from the Israelis. Mm-hmm. And the photograph that the New York Times used was not even of that hospital. They used a photograph of an entirely different building, pretending that it was the supposedly bombed hospital, right? So the New York Times does this all the time, right? That was relatively famous. It happened at the beginning of the war in Gaza. Now they're trying to convince us that there's starvation in Gaza with a child who is obviously not starving, and neither is his family, right? And as you say, when this is pointed out by an independent journalist, because if the independent journalist had not existed, nobody would have ever known that the New York Times had lied to us. Okay? So thank God for independent journalism. So, but once that happens, once the independent journalist puts up the evidence, right? The medical evidence of this child, and the New York Times is forced to correct themselves. They do it, as you say, in the back pages, almost nobody sees it normally. And even though the lie was technically corrected, it is corrected in a way that keeps the narrative going for almost everybody, right? And this is how the reality is managed. This is how the reality is managed, and these news outlets manage to keep themselves, sometimes, not always, but sometimes they manage to keep themselves technically within the bounds of, you might say, accurate reporting, at least accurate correction. But meanwhile, the false narrative is what remains in everybody's head. Okay, this is how reality is managed. There is no starvation going on in Gaza. Now, how do we know that there is no starvation going on in Gaza? It's very simple. The New York Times obviously has an interest to attack the Jewish state. They've been doing it repeatedly. Every time they can report something on the front page that makes Israel look bad, the New York Times does that. Okay, they don't do this about Qatar. Right. The New York Times is not constantly giving us stories about how 2 million slaves are suffering in Qatar, because this is happening all the time. In Qatar, there is a gigantic population of slaves who are abused physically and sexually every day, who are not paid. They can't leave. OK, they're living in Mordor. All right. And this is a state. This is a jihadi state, very tightly allied with the U.S. government, and in particular with Trump. Right. And there is never, people always claim that the media is trying to embarrass Trump. What are you talking about? It would be very easy to embarrass Trump by publicizing the story of Trump's alliance with a jihadi terror state that is enslaving two million innocent people, right? That would be a great embarrassment. No, the media doesn't complain about Qatar at all, okay? So the New York Times is not an objective organ of truth seeking. It's no such thing. The New York Times obviously has a bias to protect Qatar and attack Israel. Therefore, if the New York Times really had good evidence that there is starvation in Gaza, they would have used that. They would have used the evidence of starvation in Gaza, because what they did is very risky. It exposed them to what this guy, David Collier, the independent journalist, did. It exposed them to being shown up to be liars, right? Why would you do that to yourself? If you have good evidence of starvation, well, use that. Attack Israel with the truth. Why would you take the risk of making something up in order to attack Israel and make yourself vulnerable to being exposed? Therefore, since the New York Times went to the length of creating a hoax, because that's what they did, it proves that there is no starvation in Gaza, because they clearly want to attack Israel. And if they could do it with the truth, they would have. All right? It's a very simple analysis. So we know that there is no starvation in Gaza. This is just more propaganda. More propaganda to make people believe that somehow the Israeli Jews are just mean, you know? This is what they want people to believe. Oh, the Israeli Jews are just mean, you know? They can't look, come on, they take themselves too seriously, you know? They're too easily offended. What? Just because the Hamas terrorists go and slaughter 1,200 people, you know, innocent civilians, and then take 250 hostages, and then keep some hostages forever, never release them. You know, they just because of that, they have to go in and destroy Gaza, you know? This is crazy thinking. These people can't feel any compassion for the Jews, and they can't imagine that there's any legitimacy to Jewish acts of self-defense. It's just pure anti-Semitism. And when you see them go to these lengths to invent these hoaxes, just so that they keep, so that they can keep building this portrait of supposed Jewish evil, right? It demonstrates just how dark the forces that actually control the meaning making system of the West. I'm sorry, you wanted to say something, Yuri.
Yeah, I just realized about something that could be essential for someone who is in a neutral, right? Like they don't know what is going on and they just want to seek truth. And what you just said is that they always attack Israel and the claim that they do is always a lie.
It's always a lie.
If you only can attack Israel by telling lies, it means that you are in the right side of history. That's
right. That's right. Look, when the people who attack you have to make all kinds of stuff up, that actually speaks very well of you. Because if they could use stuff that you really did do to attack you, then they would use that. Obviously. So I like your conclusion. When mm-hmm. people who lie about, when people who want to attack you are caught making up all kinds of stuff, that is automatically an advertisement for your own virtue. Makes perfect sense. So now, the contrast, right? The contrast is tremendous because Hamas, of course, Hamas would never do this if they were not psychopaths, right? But psychopaths have their own logic. And sometimes they are surprising to us. Because we are not psychopaths, right? So what did Hamas just do? They published a video of a hostage looking awful. They published a video of a hostage looking like he's not getting fed. That guy is starving. There's no reason to believe that he's not starving, because why? How do you hoax that? I mean, it's just we know who this person was. We know he was healthy before the there he is. We know he was healthy before the September-October attack, October 7th attack. We look at him in the photo, we can see that he's not getting food, right? So this guy's starving, the other hostages are starving, but this is not what the world complains about. The world doesn't complain. The world complains that Hamas is somehow not getting what it deserves. What it deserves for what? For murdering innocent Israeli civilians, right? This is what the world is complaining about. This is what, well, not the world. We shouldn't blame the world for what the big media companies do, right? So this is the big media companies trying to poison us, right? So the contrast is really, really tremendous. Here you have a person who really is starving, who's an innocent person who was forcibly taken in a psychopathic genocidal raid, right? But he is not the one that matters. He's not the one that matters. The people that matter are the people that support this genocidal terrorist movement, because the people in Gaza voted for Hamas, elected Hamas, overwhelmingly support Hamas, according to every single poll, right? Those are the people you're supposed to worry about, the people who support the terrorists who murder innocent people and take hostages and then starve the hostages to death. This is how we're being conditioned, you see, to not reason. We're being conditioned to always say the Jews are bad, right? And then try to build an argument that will lead us to that conclusion. The conclusion is fixed. And then you try to fill it in. How are you going to fill it in? Oh, well, the New York Times showed you a photo. Are you going to question the photo? No, because if you accept the photo, then your conclusion is supported. And you always start from the conclusion, which is that the Jews are bad. Yes. See? They're building anti-Semitism. They're preparing people for the extermination of the Jewish people in Israel. This is what they're doing. They're trying to construct a moral story where the Jews are so evil that if someone killed them all, it would somehow be good. And this is what they did before World War II. Before World War II, there was an identical campaign in terms of its moral structure. The central plank of the anti-Semitic propaganda, the spinal column of the Nazi propaganda, was the claim that the Jews were a worldwide conspiracy that in secret had taken control of all of the institutions in the West. So supposedly Jews, this great Jewish conspiracy, controlled all of world finance, all of world media, the labor movements, the capitalist industries, and the governments, controlled everything. Right? Wow. And then what happened? Everybody got together to kill the Jews. And it was very easy to kill them. So the propaganda that scared everybody about the Jews and which produced the genocide, the great genocide of the 20th century, that propaganda proved that it was propaganda. Because when it caused the genocide, none of those institutions that were supposedly controlled by the Jews lifted a finger to defend them. To the contrary, they collaborated in the process that brought the European Jewish people to destruction. So this is always how it works. First, you demonize the Jews, you convince people that the Jews are evil. And then once you convince them that they're evil, that they're satanic, that they're coming for you, it becomes a good thing, right? It becomes an act of redemption to go and kill them. This is a very, very dark thing. And it's been happening this way for centuries. So today they tell us that Jews are supposedly committing genocide and starvation in Gaza, right? So that you will think, oh, they must be evil. How could they do anything like that? They must be evil. In the previous iteration, they were convincing you, and this still happens today as well, that the Jews controlled everything in secret and we're going to use their clandestine secret power to strangle everybody else and destroy Western civilization, right? In the iteration before that, the heaviest message was that the Jews were murdering Christian children. Okay, so in the Middle Ages, they would tell Christians that the Jews supposedly kidnapped Christian children so that they could eat them. This is what they told these illiterate Christians in the Middle Ages. This is what the Dominican and Franciscan friars that were going all over Europe talking to the poor, right? This is what they were telling them. They were telling them that the Jews kidnapped Christian children to eat them, that the Jews were vampires. This is what they told them. So of course there were enormous mass killings of Jews in the Middle Ages. Of course, the Christians were terrified of the Jews. And they thought killing Jews was a good thing because that meant protecting their own children from vampires, right? In those accusations of the Middle Ages, those were built on a very strong foundation of propaganda that goes all the way back to the first century that claims that the Jews killed God. Okay? This is in the Christian Gospels. The Christian Gospels claim that a giant multitude of Jews threatened the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, with a rebellion unless the Roman governor executed Jesus. That's the story of the Gospels. So Jesus to Christians is God the Son. So the story that they've been hearing for 2,000 years now from their religious authorities, in other words, the authorities with the greatest prestige on what the cosmos means, right? From those authorities, they've been hearing that the Jews killed God the Son. The Jews killed God. Can you imagine how easy it becomes to mobilize people against the Jews after you convince them that they killed God? Can you imagine the terror that you can strike in the hearts of people if they think the Jews killed God? They must have some tremendous satanic power that they can kill God. Oh my God, you know? So of course, people became terrified and it became very easy to mobilize them against the Jews. And this is what's been happening century after century after century in Western civilization. And they're doing it again. And it was very important that we talk about this particular topic today, because what we've been noticing is that this latest accusation, the accusation of starvation in Gaza, this alleged starvation in Gaza, it is convincing even many Jews. So this is a very serious thing. Even many Jews who up to now were resisting the propaganda with these new claims of, oh, you know, but look, the kids are starving in Gaza. No, this last accusation, it's getting them. A lot of Jews are thinking, oh, this is too much. Now they went too far. What? No, they didn't go too far. This is just another lie. It's just the latest lie. Like the lie that the IDF is supposedly killing a lot of civilians in Gaza. That information also comes from Hamas. It's also the media repeating whatever Hamas says, right? So I was listening to a British military expert the other day on some show. He was being interviewed on a very good show. I forget the name of the podcaster. I should remember because he's very good. I'll mention it tomorrow in the Spanish broadcast. But this podcaster was interviewing the British military expert, and the expert was saying that he had conducted research into how the media talks about the figures about the estimates of casualties in Gaza. Okay? That was popular. And what the expert was saying was that the media, something like 97% of the time, repeat only the figures, only the numbers that Hamas gives. Either they only use the figures that Hamas gives, or they use the figures of Hamas as if they were obviously correct. And express skepticism for the numbers that the IDF puts out. So the media has an overwhelming bias to repeat the propaganda of the psychopathic terrorists who announce in their constitution that they mean to commit genocide against the Israeli Jews and Jews everywhere. And they express skepticism for the estimates produced by the democratic government of the state of Israel, which is trying very hard not to kill Arab Palestinians. They bend over backwards. Whereas the Arab terrorists of Hamas have an explicit policy to murder Arab Palestinians. They have a human shields policy, a human bait policy. And obviously the strategic advantage is that they know that they can always rely on the media to report anything bad that happens in Gaza as the fault of the Israelis. So the Arab terrorists are always trying to get their own Arabs killed because they know the Western media will blame Israel, right? Amazing. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that perfectly diagnostic of who really controls the media? And yet, if you ask the people on the street, they will tell you that they think the Jews control the media.
Yes.
Why would Jewish control of the media be consistent with nothing but lies to discredit the state of Israel?
Themselves, yeah.
Does anybody ask themselves this question? The very fact that the New York Times goes to the extreme length of hoaxing this phony starvation in Gaza, all by itself demonstrates that the Jews don't control the media, because the New York Times is the paper that sets the entire media narrative. Everybody follows them. So the fact that the New York Times produces a hoax to claim starvation in Gaza, that by itself, I mean, I could give you a long list of demonstrations, but that by itself demonstrates that the Jews don't control the media. Nothing could be more obvious, right? But people feel they have to say that the Jews control the media because they hate the media and they hate the Jews. And the conclusion that the Jews are bad has to be suspended in the air at the beginning of any quote-unquote reasoning process, right? This is not real reasoning. This is just prejudice. So you suspend the conclusion, and then you try to construct some kind of pseudo-argument all the way to the ground so that you will be able to justify your conclusion.
I like that. And that reminds me of a quote that Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda, said of the German Nazis, said. He said, a lie that's repeated 1,000 times, it becomes true even to the most intelligent person, right? And that's what's happening now. Like even the Jews who know history, who know about the roots, now start to doubt about what is going on in Gaza and if they're starving.
Well, this is why I think your observation is right on point, and I think this is why it's important to do the work we do. If I can do a little advertisement for the management of reality, I think the work we do is fundamental, because you cannot win this information war, this meaning war, by refuting every lie that they put out. It's just too many lies. Almost everything they say is false. Almost everything that is important that has to do with political questions that are transcendental, okay, that you hear in the mainstream media, almost all of that is false. And so you can't win by trying to refute everything. That's death by 1,000 cuts. They'll beat you. They're going to win if your strategy is to try to return fire after every single lie. You're going to lose. It's too many lies. They have too much power. They have too much reach, right? So the strategy we are following is to try to explain to people the historical structure that built the media system. How is the media and academic system built? Because the media and the academic institutions together are the institutions that construct our reality. They manage our reality. Okay, they create meaning for us. They tell us what is supposedly happening, and they also interpret it for us. They tell us what it means, right? Hmm. So if we can explain to people and document for people how that system, how that media academic system was put together and who controls it, then you can produce skepticism about the entire narrative. And then you don't have to be refuting every single lie, every single new lie, because people now understand that the enemy is talking to them. Okay, so this is why I always place so much emphasis in teaching people about Christopher Simpson's very important research. Historian Christopher Simpson, who is at American University, documented in Blowback, a book that he published in 1988, he published that the CIA was created by absorbing tens of thousands of Nazis. Now, this is something we have to keep repeating. And we have the article. Let me show people the article. Let me see. Where do I have this? So we have it on Management of Reality, right, on our Substack. If you go to the archive and you type Nazis, right, it'll pop right up. It's this one. How many Nazis were secretly recruited at the creation of the CIA? Okay. And it turns out it was tens of thousands. Okay. At the end of World War II, the Allies captured Reinhard Gehlen. General Reinhard Gehlen, who had been Adolf Hitler's chief of intelligence for Fremde Heer Ost, which was the intelligence structure of foreign armies east, where the worst crimes happened, where the worst crimes of war took place. So this guy was a complete monster. I mean, it would take us a long time to give the catalog of his crimes. And so they, at the end of the war, the Allies capture this guy, and he says, "Hey, what? You know what? If you like, I can recreate for you Hitler's intelligence infrastructure in Eastern Europe." And the U.S. military said, "Yeah, sure, go for it." And that's what became the CIA. We're talking about tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals and Nazi collaborators. The consequence of this is that U.S. foreign policy has to have a Nazi bent, because U.S. foreign policy is cooked at the CIA. Okay, so that's point one. Point two is that if you have a clandestine service made up of Nazis, and you give them the power to spend the money of U.S. citizens in secret, which is what happened, because the 1947 National Security Act, the law that created the CIA, authorizes U.S. intelligence to initiate any activity at any time without asking anybody. And we have an article to explain that. I'll put it up on the screen. So let me return here. Because I want people to be able to see this documentation. So if you go to the archive again, and you, by the way, I don't think we are live on, oh yeah, we are. If you go to the archive and you type here in National Security Act of 1947, there it is, okay? Click on that. And here you will see explained, and we quote the relevant portions of the act so that you can see what they're saying and what it means. And we have a link to the full text of the act if you want to go read the whole thing. What it says is that it doesn't matter what they want to do. They can just go ahead and do it. They don't have to ask anybody, and they can postpone indefinitely the report of any activity, so long as they stamp it as, you know, a national security secret. That's all they have to do. And it'll be, the report can be postponed indefinitely. So you give these people, the Nazis, because it was created out of Nazis, you give them the power to spend as much money as they want in secret, basically, because the it turns out that the budget of the CIA is a state secret. So for all practical purposes, it's infinite.
Yes.
You give them that power. What are these Nazis going to do? Well, of course they're going to corrupt the entire media and academic system, because the media and academic system is the thing that you have to corrupt if you want to take control over reality. Now, in Nazi Germany, this was all done transparently, because Nazi Germany was openly a totalitarian state, right? But in the United States and in the rest of the West, you have to do this clandestinely, because the United States and the other Western states call themselves democracies, and the people running these states have to preserve the fiction for their citizenries that they are living in a free state, that they are citizens of a democratic polity. Okay, so in those states, the work of transforming the media and academic systems has to be done clandestinely, and the surface appearance of freedom has to be preserved. So this is done through the intelligence services in the shadows, okay? And guess what else Christopher Simpson documented? Once again, you go to the archive of Management of Reality, and you type in there, let's see, you type, here it is. Here's the article: Psychological Warfare, Communication Research, Media, and Academia. And what Christopher Simpson, because he also did this research, what he showed here is that immediately after World War II, the CIA set up the new departments of communication and institutes that study communication research in the different elite universities of the United States. So before this, departments of communication didn't exist. They were suddenly created in a 10-year period immediately after the war, okay, in the 50s. And these departments of communication were staffed by the same people that had been doing psychological warfare for the United States during World War II. In other words, the people running the communication research departments were the same experts that had been producing, that had been managing reality for millions of people, okay? That had been creating fake realities for millions of people to manipulate them during the Second World War. Those experts became the professors at elite universities teaching the new discipline of communication research. And those departments were created with CIA money laundered via the Rockefeller and Carnegie and Ford foundations. Okay? This is what they did after the war. And guess what? Those departments of communication train all of the people who work in the mainstream mass media. So before these departments of communication existed, journalists tended to be, you know, lower middle class or working class people who decided they were interested in investigating the truth about something, and they became journalists. They were not typically college educated people. I mean, some of them might be, but there was no expectation that they should be, and most of them were not. But after these departments of communication research were created, it became a kind of a bureaucratic process that if you want to be anywhere, if you want to be hired anywhere in mass media, you first have to get some kind of degree of journalism or communication from these departments. And then you can get hired in the mass media. So the system that was set up by the CIA is one where their own experts in psychological warfare end up training all of the people who have the job of creating content in the mass media. That's the world we live in. That's the world we live in. The Jews don't control the media. The Nazis control the media, which explains, of course, why the entire world is trying to destroy Israel, because the media everywhere is creating this envelope of reality where the Jews look bad, right? So where the Jews are supposedly committing genocide in Gaza, and the Jews are supposedly starving people in Gaza, and you're not supposed to notice that the terrorists in Gaza murdered 1,200, they tortured to death 1,200 people, took hostages, and then never released all of the hostages. So the very simple fact that this conflict could have ended in the first 2 weeks if Hamas had released all of the hostages, because that's what would have happened, that is completely lost. This is nowhere in view now for people. And the people who are blamed are the people who were victimized. The people who are called genocidal monsters are the people who were attacked by a terrorist group that says in public that they mean to commit genocide against the Israeli Jews. It's really quite remarkable, and you couldn't possibly get such Orwellian reversals. The media were not, in fact, controlled by the enemies of the Jews.
That's insane. That, because I'm so disappointed at the society.
It's very disappointing that the Jews, it's very disappointing that the Nazis run the world.
No. I'm disappointed at the society. Like, I see this this news that we already shown, and we go backwards into about that, and where you see a hostage here, right, like very very thin, very unhealthy, like digging his own grave, like that cannot be any more psychopathic of
the, I know,
for right, and to publicly make a video to everywhere, and no one is talking about that.
Right.
Only Jewish are protecting him, right, but no one else. Everyone else is talking about the supposedly starvation that Israeli is committing.
That's right. Nobody in the media is offended by this. Nobody in the media is offended that Hamas is boasting that they torture people to death. This is quite remarkable.
That's insane. Like, that's so effective.
This can only happen if the meaning system is in the hands of the enemies of the Jews. It's the only explanation. We should take it seriously, because what this means, the fact that we are being prepared to accept and applaud a genocide of the Jews, because that's what's happening. People are being prepared to accept and applaud a genocide of the Jews. It's the same process that led us to World War II and the Shoah and the Holocaust. And the fact that this is going on means that we are very close to the collapse of the West. The same collapse of the West that I have been predicting for over 20 years, right? Just let me brag a little bit about this, because the one thing we can say is that our model has made perfectly good predictions. So if people speak Spanish and they want to see the books where I predicted this long time ago. The books are not more than 20 years old, but the prediction is the books are from 2013 is when I started publishing these books, right? Here they are. You go to managementofreality.com and then you click on book. And if you speak Spanish, you can read these, okay? It's called The Collapse. The series is called The Collapse of the West, The Next Holocaust and Its Consequences. Why this title? Because every time there's a great mass killing or mass persecution of Jews, you know, slaughters, forced conversions, expulsions, etc. Every single time that this happens in the West, all of the non-Jews are enslaved. All of the non-Jews are enslaved. It is happening now. The attacker, the state that attacked Israel on October 7th, 2023 is Qatar, because Qatar is the sugar daddy of Hamas. And Qatar is a slave state, because that's what jihadis do. They have 2 million slaves there. Okay. So it is happening now. The people producing slaughters of Jews are enslaving all of us. They're beginning to enslave all of us. This is their program. The Nazis did it. The Nazis exterminated the Jews in Europe, and they were enslaving everybody. They enslaved absolutely everybody. They started with the Germans. The first slaves of the Nazis were the Germans. It happened with the Russians. It happened with the Inquisitors. It happened with the Greco-Romans. Okay, it's always the same story. The people who murder the Jews enslave all of us. So the fact that these people who control our institutions, right? The people who control the CIA, the Nazis, and through the CIA have corrupted the entire institutional system. Those people, the fact that they're now so avidly, so energetically preparing us to accept and applaud an anti-Jewish genocide means that we are all about to be enslaved. That's what it means. And if you, the non-Jew, do not wish to be a slave. If you're a non-Jew like me and you don't want to be enslaved, hurry up and defend the Jews, because that's the only thing that's going to save your skin. It's the only thing that's going to save your skin. If the goyim, if the non-Jews of the West had defended the Jews with ferocity and with unanimity in the 1920s, in the 1930s, the Nazis would have never even come to power. And we wouldn't have had a World War II. And over 64 million non-Jews would not have been killed. And hundreds of millions of non-Jews would not have been enslaved by the Nazis. All right? So that's the lesson we should have learned after World War II. The lesson we should have learned is, oh my God, anti-Semitism is a tremendous danger to non-Jews. Because we just got killed and enslaved by the hundreds of millions by these anti-Semites. So obviously the anti-Semites are a tremendous danger to non-Jews. Tremendous danger. That's the lesson of World War II. But we couldn't learn it. We couldn't learn it. And once again, we are listening to the same media that poisoned our minds before World War II, that caused so much harm to the entire West, to so many, many Westerners, so much suffering. And we are rushing into the same pit once again. We are allowing the anti-Semites to poison our minds, preparing us for our own enslavement, because that's what's going to follow the next genocide of the Jewish people. That's what's going to follow. It's a complete collapse of the West, complete implosion of all democratic institutions, complete implosion of every right and liberty that we have enjoyed, to fold us again into totalitarianism.
Yeah. And
given the technologies that are now becoming available for these monsters to use, and given the strategy they're employing, which is to replace us with Islam, I think the future is very dark. If the West collapses, it will not rise again. I think it'll be game over. And therefore, it is important for this generation to understand that it falls to us to fight for the West. The next generation will not have this opportunity. We are the ones that have to save the West. So it's a little bit like that scene in The Lord of the Rings, when Gandalf refuses the ring, right? So Frodo is holding the ring and he offers it to Gandalf, and Gandalf gets very upset and he says, "Don't ever offer that thing to me again, because I cannot resist it. You know, it's too much power. I would think that I'm using it for good, but it would take me over. I can't control that power." And then Frodo realizes that the ring doesn't have that power over him, right? So he understands, oh, Gandalf cannot have the ring, but I can hold the ring. And in that moment, he closes his hand over the ring. He goes like this. The ring is on the palm of his hand. He closes his hand over the ring, and he looks at Gandalf and he says, "What must I do?" Because in that moment, Frodo understands that the responsibility for saving the entire world has now suddenly come upon him, because he can resist the ring. You see? He didn't ask for it. He didn't ask for this. He was just the right person at the right time in the right place. And he accepts the responsibility. Okay? It falls on him, and then he accepts it. And that's why Frodo is a hero. That's the meaning of a hero. And history is calling upon us to be heroes. This generation has to be a heroic generation. We didn't ask for this. It landed on our heads. The great crisis of the history of the world landed on our heads. And we have to accept this responsibility, because every human generation is now depending upon us. I think it is time that we examine clearly our leaders, or the people who are saying they want to be our leaders, and scrutinize them carefully, because they have to be the right leaders. And tomorrow in the Spanish podcast, I will be speaking of Moshe Feiglin, who I believe is saying the right things, and looks like the man who can lead the nation of Israel in this dark moment. Because salvation, as always in the West, will have to come from the nation of Israel. The Jews are going to have to show us the way. Of course, we have to listen, but the Jews are going to have to show us the way, because the Jewish people is the people that invented the fight for freedom. They are the people organized around a body of law born in a slave revolt. And they are the ones who bequeathed to us a system of ethics and law designed to help us fight oppression and gain our freedom. They're the ones who taught us that. Before the Jewish people started influencing the West, we were living in the most psychopathic, oppressive, warlike, repressive societies in the world. The Greco-Roman world was the most incredible nightmare. It was like some nightmare out of Tolkien. It was Mordor. That's what the Greco-Roman world was like. And it is again diagnostic of who really is running our societies, that in our academic system, in our schools, we are always taught to admire and defend the ancient Greco-Romans as our forefathers and as the supposed originators of our democracy, right? When in fact, those people had oceans of slaves and they were treating them with utmost cruelty. They had death camps. Like the mines of Laurion, south of Athens, were effectively death camps. Tens of thousands of slaves were worked to death in the mines of Laurion. So those were our societies. Okay, those were our societies when the Jews began influencing us, and it was thanks to the ethical impact of Jewish thinking on the Greco-Romans that we gradually started to get better. We kept killing the Jews. We somehow can't stop killing Jews. But despite that, Jewish influence made us better through the centuries until Judeo-Christian Western civilization produced modern democracy. And that's what we're about to lose. So the Jews will have to show us the way again, because we can't do it without the Jews. They will have to do it again. But I'm calling on the non-Jews like me to follow, to listen, and to follow the Jewish example, the example that the brave Jewish soldiers are giving in Israel, who are on the front line fighting against jihadism. As long as they do that, as long as they are undefeated, they're helping to keep the West safe. But they're not going to be able to do it without us either. I mean, we really have to join this fight. So the first thing we have to do is again ground ourselves in skepticism. This is what the management of reality is all about. What we are teaching people is to ground themselves in skepticism and in a scientific understanding of the history of how the Western system was put together, the modern Western system, and in particular the institutions of media and academia that are responsible for managing our reality and creating meaning, okay? We need to emancipate ourselves from that first, because if not, they will just keep firing lies, one lie after another, and they keep distracting us and confusing us, and we can't emerge from this sphere of reality that they create around us. We can't emerge enough to defend ourselves, okay? So take it seriously. This whole starvation propaganda is a lie. The minute you accept it, the minute you fit that into the whole catalog of lies that we have been hearing about the state of Israel, designed to destroy the prestige of Israel and to raise the prestige of the jihadi terrorists, once you emancipate yourself from that, now you can begin defending the West. But the first thing you have to free yourself of is the meaning system that the enemy has created. That's the first thing.
Yes, and I really listen to you, Francisco, and I really think this is our last chance. And it's like the strategy that they use, I agree with you, is like they try first to have this idea of that the Jews are bad in order to destroy them, to destroy all Israel. And I can relate this to a recent catastrophe that happened like 1 month or 2 months ago in New York. A couple was killed by a terrorist, was shot. I don't know if you remember. And what they said afterwards, I listened to some influencers, young influencers, like 20 years old in TikTok, who has like millions of followers. And what they said, they justified it. No, they didn't kill them because they were Jewish, because they were Zionists. You know, like they tried to justify all these kind of things, like, no, it's good to kill if they're Zionists or whatever. You know, no. So they tried to insert.
Yeah, they're dehumanizing the Jewish people. This is always what they do before they kill them. That's what's going on. Look, I want to share my screen again just for a second.
Yes.
Because I want to tell people that we have a series. Let me I don't know how to do this. Let me see. We have okay, here we go. So the last articles that we've published, like this one here, A Jewish-Led Revolution in the First Century BCE Rome, or this one about Hillel the Elder and so forth. So these are articles about that are in a series about the role of the Semitic movement with the lowercase s. So this is Semitic in the sense of Semitism. Okay, this is a term I invented. And Semitism, it stands for an ideology that comes out of Mesopotamia, of the very ancient Mesopotamia. It's the oldest ethical movement in history, the oldest sort of stable ethical movement, a continuing ethical movement in history. And this movement is what produced Judaism. Okay, Babylonian Semitism is what produced Judaism. And we explained that in this series. I'll go to the first one. Go to the first article. It's called Semitism versus Anti-Semitism. And we show you that this is a process that is 4,300 years old. Okay? This is, again, it's like out of Tolkien. It's like out of The Lord of the Rings. It's a battle between good and evil that is 4,300 years old. And Semitism are the good guys. And anti-Semitism, those are the bad guys. And the Jewish people comes out of Semitism. And they are the ones who bring this ethical, legal, philosophical movement that grew out of Babylonia. They're the ones who bring it into the West, okay? Hmm. It's thanks to that movement that the West got better, that the West evolved from the psychopathy of the Greco-Romans to the compassion and justice of modern Judeo-Christian democracy, okay? It is important to know this story because it is important to know what we're fighting for. This is a struggle that has been going on for 4,300 years, and it is possible that the anti-Semitic enemy will now win. We cannot allow that to happen. We have to flip the system in favor of Semitism, in favor of ethics, justice, compassion, truth, liberty. We have to join together as one. The Westerners, listen, most Westerners are good people. The people who are fighting on the wrong side of history right now are mostly misinformed. They're misinformed. And if we can emancipate them from the reality envelope created by the enemy, we can definitely save the West. But we have to put our shoulder to the wheel. And we have to know what we're fighting for. We have to recover our Western identity. We have to understand what earlier generations of people fighting on the right side of history have done, and to truly assimilate them as our forefathers, as the people who bequeathed to us the system of values that we should now defend before it's too late. So knowing this history is really, in my opinion, it's really fundamental. And I invite our audience to take the plunge and learn about the great struggle between Semitism and anti-Semitism that has been going on for 4,300 years in Western Asia, all of Western Asia, which is one great political system. Western Asia, of course, includes Europe and the Mediterranean, and now ideologically it includes all of the West, which is all of the descendant societies of Europe, okay? All of that is at risk now. It's on the verge of collapse. We can still save it. We have the tools to do it. We have the communication tools to reach every single Westerner. But we have to take it seriously. We have to join the fight. We have to put our shoulder to the wheel. And in to the extent that we have resources, we need to invest them, whether it's time whether it's effort, whether it's money, whether it's connections, whatever resources we have to invest them in the fight for the future of the West. So that is my message. Don't believe the lies. Don't believe the starvation lies. It's just the latest lie. They're going to keep lying. There are going to be new lies next week. You need to understand the system so that you're not moved and swayed by every last lie. Okay. First thing we need to do is emancipate us and emancipate ourselves, forgive me, from the management of reality. So I'll leave you with that. And I'll see everybody tomorrow in the Spanish podcast, same time. And next week, again on Monday, on our English podcast. Thank you, everybody. Subscribe, like, tick the bell, and share, because we need to reach everybody.
Goodbye. Yes. Thank you so much to everyone, and see you next time.